Hello, everybody. Welcome to the sixth deep reinforcement learning lecture. We are already near the middle or of the semester, which is terrifying, but it's really the case. Maybe I should just switch the light on so that you will be able to see me better. Something like this. First, are there any questions regarding whatever you're interested in? We finished the rainbow, so these improvements to the deep Q networks on the previous lecture, so it was pretty self-contained, hopefully. If there are any questions or something, yes. I don't really like if there would be a square, I would just consider it to be the like to be hidden in this W exactly as you say. I don't really think people are looking too much into it. These are just numbers, right? At this point, no vectors or something. So if generally, I don't think there is too much interpretability of like using the priorities corresponding just exactly to this distance. So like I think this was an arbitrary choice anyway, right? Whether you want to the probabilities to be proportional to this L1 norm or whether you would want them to be similar to the L2 norm. That's just what we hoped that would help. And I am not aware of any interpretability of that choice. So from this point of view, I'm not sure people know. So I think it's more about just really trying and then seeing what helps more. Even with this choice of the exponent, people are just trying like what good hyperparameter it will be. So if this would come up as two, then probably using the square distance would be the good thing. If I recall, people tend to use exponents like 0.5. So relying too much on this information probably is not as useful, but I'm not aware of anything else than this engineering approach. So I would just go for the hyperparameter which works the best. Yep, and they say they are using 0.5. I'm not sure if they showed also what the grid search they ran for this parameter, but I think this is consistent with what they did also in the paper. So not much details from me. Some other questions, ideas, obvious improvements. Well, I would say over 900. I may even have here some implementation from the one which got the highest score on the previous yep, on the previous one. So I can even show you if I can do it. Yeah, but I would need the virtual environment with Torch, which I don't have. Okay, so I won't be able to show you, but the good results are like consistent 900s. The word consistent is an important one because we are evaluating only on 15 episodes, which is actually a quite small number. So what you need to make sure is that it doesn't happen that in one of these episodes, the car just gets off the track and gets lost. So in a sense, it's more useful to be conservative, and it's better to come up with an algorithm which has 880 on the average but has a very low variance compared to 910, which would have higher variance. I can even show you the results from the last years if you want, but that will be a hint. I won't show you. You're welcome. Yeah, for the car racing, I was always able to get the rendering of these some number of the best solution. So hopefully we'll be also able to look or watch what the algorithms actually did and how they behaved. So we will see if these things, like somebody having great 14 rides and then just turning around and not doing anything, if it happened. Sometimes it also happened, I've seen that in many train agents, that the queue policy decides not to move. Like the current best action is to do nothing. And if this happens, then the car will not move at all. It will just stand there still without moving. Generally, it might happen if the image is considerably different to whatever the network saw during training, or it's some configuration of the input which it didn't really observe. Maybe the situation where the car is staying still, because that's something what will not happen with the epsilon greedy exploration, right? If you are using some epsilon soft strategy for exploration, then even if the policy tells you to stand still, it will move the engine. So you can rely on the history of the frames to actually see some movement, right? But then if you stop using this epsilon greedy performing of actions, it might happen that you just see the same input image for all the input frames. And this is something what the network didn't see during training. And it might produce like the action of like do nothing, no operation. And then the car is just stuck there. So I've seen this many times in the trained cars. So somebody, it was maybe or actually you who asked about whether it makes sense to do some exploration even during the inference, and this might be one of these cases, for example, or maybe especially, or you can have like a manual switch which says, okay, I haven't moved in 10 frames, that's bad, so let's go forward. Well, with the noisy nets, I am thinking whether you are actually using noisy nets without the noise, right? Maybe you are, but what I'm thinking is whether during inference you are actually using or not using the noise, because some of these policies tend to be a bit stochastic, the ones which they are trained. So personally, I would just use the noise even during inference. Now I'm intrigued. I will read the paper after the lecture, because I cannot answer whether they actually use the noise during inference or not. Don't you know, some of you? Yep. Like it's a bit specific. Like when we have the noise in these noise nets, then not having them at all creates the input which the network once again like didn't really see at all. Like it saw it somehow on average, but it's difficult to say whether it will behave nicely even when not using the epsilon or not. I wouldn't really dare to guess whether it will be fine or not. Yep. So some other ideas, questions, something. If no, then let me get to the lecture and we will start talking about a different approach to functional approximation of reinforcement learning, and these will be the policy gradient methods. So this is an approach quite different to the deep Q networks which we have seen until now. And the idea is that instead of just predicting the returns, we could train our models, neural network presumably, to predict directly the policy, right? So instead of estimating how well the action in the given state would be, what the expected return which we'll get when we perform this action in this given state, we could just want to get a distribution of the actions which we want to take in the given state, right? So for the optimum policy, ideally this distribution would just return only the actions which are really the best ones in the given state, but of course during training we will just get some distribution. It would be interesting in several ways. Getting the full distribution would allow the policies to be stochastic. It would also allow us to sample the actions in a more intelligent way. Right now, when we want to do some exploration, we just close our eyes and do just random action, even if it's a terrible action in the given state. And maybe it would be better to use some more informed decision. I don't know, imagine that you want to go to the restaurant and you want to be in the exploration mode, right? So instead of eating the pizza, which you like and you eat frequently, you just decide to try something new, right? But instead of actually choosing something which is something you at least expect to like, you will just use a random choice, right? So for example, if you really hate fish, then maybe ordering fish is not a great idea. But if we got the whole distribution, this distribution could give us information whether the different actions have some chance of actually producing a good result or not. So we could just sample the actions from the generated distribution instead of just taking uniform distribution, which we use in the epsilon of the cases. However, in order to be able to train a network which predicts the policy, we will need to maximize, we will need a way to compute the gradient. And the gradient will be of the expected return, right? Because when we are given S, we want to maximize the return which we can get in this state. So this is the value which we would need to compute the gradient of in order to update the parameters of this policy. And that's exactly what we will be able to do. And this policy gradient in the name of the, or in the title of the slide, tells us that we will probably be able to do it somehow. Yeah, so I already mentioned it, that in addition to being able to discarding this epsilon greedy action selection, getting the full policy will allow us to naturally support stochastic policies, either ones where you just decide to do some random action in a given state. This was difficult to do with the action value methods, like the one where we get these Q estimates, because if you saw that one action has an expected return of 10 and the other of 10.1, it wasn't obvious how frequently you should perform either this or this action, while we will get the distribution which will tell us exactly this. There is an example in the the reinforcement learning book, which shows that the stochastic policies might be interesting. And there is in this specific example, there are just three states. And I'm sorry, I'm just writing down the slide because once again, there is this bad black thing, which I'll just get rid of. So we have got four states. This is the terminal states. We start here. And the idea is that we cannot distinguish these states on the input. And they have different behavior. So here, the action left really goes to the left and the right really goes to the right. But here, the action to the right goes to the left. And here, left action goes to the right. And here, it's fine again. Right. If you cannot distinguish these states in the agent, then either going all the time to the left or going all the time to the right is not a good idea, because you need to be able to frequently do both left and right movement. Right. So if you only perform this epsilon greedy strategy, then in order to reach the goal, you need to go to the right, and then here the policy probably also says to the right because you can distinguish the states, and you have to be lucky to actually get left because of this epsilon greedy strategy, and then once again to the right. However, with the policy gradient methods, we can easily train a stochastic policy because sometimes it will be good to go to the right, it will sometimes be good to go to the left. So the gradient of the expected return will reflect this, and it will train this stochastic combination with the, I don't know how much like with this probability of choosing the right action. So that's another thing which we hope to get by. Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. The difficult thing is that just passing it through some unsupervised method will not be enough, right? If you just use softmax, then it may not be the case that the correct distribution of actions actually depends on some fixed specific way on just on the action values, right? You never know whether one is large difference or not, and it may not even be linear. So maybe for some actions, if they're have a distance of one, it's a lot, and you don't want to do the second action at all, but maybe this one and 10 is very similar, so it's not very instructive what I'm saying. But what if we want to solve this issue with action value methods, then what we would do is we would need to turn to the distributional reinforcement learning, right? That's what we talked about at the end of the Rainbow lecture, and they do what you would expect, right? They produce some weights for each state and action and the support, and then they compute the softmax. But this is trained for the whole training so that it generates a correct distribution. So we need to update the training procedure to actually understand that it's generating the distribution of rewards. And once you have a distribution of rewards for each action, you can start sampling somehow. Right? If you see, I don't know, this left image, you can see what you are expected to get in the yellow, blue, and red actions, so you can then think about the reasonable ratios of which of those you would actually want to do. So it is possible, but you probably need to not do it just by some unsupervised method, but even during training, train the function which will get you the correct function, so that you know that you are really processing some distributions and so on. You're welcome. So I assume most of you have seen the policy gradient theorem anyway on the summer lecture, but maybe some of you won't, and we also talk about the termination. So there still should be something new for you. So now let's get to the important thing, which is the policy gradient theorem, which will allow us to compute the required gradient to tell us how should we update the parameters of the policy in order to improve our behavior. So assume that we have got this initial state distribution HS and this on policy distribution under our policy pi mu s. We will denote this J function as the expectation of return in the state S, assuming our policy and our initial state distribution. And then the theorem says that the gradient with respect to the value function in the given state is proportional to the following quantity. We consider all possible states and compute the probability of reaching the state S prime from the given S using any number of steps with regard to the policy. So this is like the distribution. It's like a part, like smaller part of this mu s, but instead it's the distribution, like the probability of getting to some state s prime when we start with this one fixed state s. So this tells us which states do we get to from this one, and then for each state, we consider all possible actions, and for each action, we compute the action value function of this state and action and the gradient of the policy. So what does this mean? This is obvious. We consider all possible states, and the likely we are to get to the S prime from S, the more strongly we consider it. And then we consider all the actions, and the better the action is in the state, then the more we will update the parameters in order to generate this action A in this state S prime, right? So this part, this gradient on the right, tells us how to update the parameters theta in order to generate more A's in the given S prime. And we perform this update by weighting it by two information. One is how often do we actually get to this S prime? So we don't do it if we don't get to S prime too often. And also how well this specific action will do in this state S prime if we perform it, right? So intuitively, it seems like a reasonable theorem. And then this is just for one state, and if we don't want to start in some specific state, but generally contain the states with respect to this on policy distribution, then we consider all states, just how often do we really visit them, independently on in which state we start with, and the rest is still the same. This is one that's again only proportional to. This probability is so for finite horizon tasks, it's really a reasonable thing. It tells us what the policy is, what the probability is to actually get there in the rest of the episode, right? And if there is a limit on the length of the episode, then this is just proportional to getting from S to S prime in some number of steps, and there is just a finite number of them for all the episodes. Otherwise, if we have a continuous if we are in the continuous environment, when we have a continuing task, I'm sorry, it's similar but quite different. If we are in a continuing task, then this should probably be the probability of getting from S to S prime directly in one step, right? Because Once we get to this stationary distribution, then the probability of getting to S prime doesn't really depend on the number of steps which we will make. And in the last situation, when we have the episodic tasks without any fixed limit on the length of the episode, we need to use the gamma parameter, the discount parameter, to make sure that this is actually a reasonable or even defined distribution, right? So if there is some non-one gamma parameter, then we should do the same thing which we already talked about when we defined the on-policy distribution and use it as a form of termination, right? So this probability of reaching the S prime state from S depends on the length of the journey, and we take the probability of reaching it in k steps and multiply it by gamma to k, right? So the idea was that we can encompass this discount factor inside the environment by actually rolling a die each time we perform a step, and with the probability of 1 minus gamma we just stop. Right, so if from this interpretation, we can embed gamma in the MDP in this way. And this allows us to for this probability to be reasonable, even if we consider unlimited number of steps, because this gamma to k will make sure that the contributions for the longer and longer journeys will go down. So it's like a discounted probability of actually getting there. As for the proof, it should be quite straightforward. So we know that the value function can be computed by going through all the actions, considering their probability under the target policy pi, and then looking at the action value function. So this is just the expectation over the actions. And now we will compute the gradient of this sum. So the gradient can go inside the sum without any problem. And then we have the multiplication here. So we will compute the partial derivatives of the first factor times the second one, and the first factor times the gradient of the second one. This first one is fine, and we will not update it anymore. We'll just keep it there, because computing the gradient of the policy is simple. However, the second one is a bit more convoluted, because we need to compute the gradient of the action value function, which of course is difficult. So the only thing which we have is the definition of this action value function. So we use it and we say, okay, so this action value function can be evaluated by considering all the following states and also rewards. I've just not included the reward here because it will just disappear immediately. But formally it should have been here, right? There should have been a reward, and there should have been a reward here. But I just marginalized over it. Now when we consider this factor here, what the gradient will do, the gradient is with respect to the parameters which define the policy. So the probability gets a zero gradient, the reward gets a zero gradient. The only interesting part is this value function, which will actually change when the parameters of the policy will change. So what we get gamma, which will just go outside. The reward is cancelled. The policies stay. The probability of reaching the next state stays as a constant, and then we need to compute the gradient of the value function in the next state. And now we got from the value function in one state to the value function in state S prime, and we'll be able to repeat the same by using the same way or same approach, right? So if we do it, then we expand it to a very similar factor, or it's not an equation, it's just an expression. Yeah, that's the right thing. So we go over the actions. This time we are computing the gradient with respect to taking action A prime in the state S prime. And then we have the right hand side with which once again contain the value function in the next state. And we can do this over and over and over and over. And in the end, what will happen? Well, we will get a lot of these terms, which contains the action value functions and the gradient of the policy. And it appears here many times whenever we find a step, we find a path or a trajectory which starts in the state S prime and then gets to it's an S and gets to S prime in exactly k steps, right? Because there is first taking this this action A in the state S, the probability of actually reaching S prime, and then the probability of taking this next action A prime, and the probability of reaching S double prime, and we include this factor of gamma for each step we take. So this is what we get when we expand it infinitely many times, enough times in practice probably, and we are nearly there, right? This there should be comma to k here. So this discounted probability of reaching the state S, that's exactly what we denoted as probability of reaching that state S prime. So the we already have the first part of the theorem. Here we have equality, but this is no longer a probability, right? This is a number which can be much larger than one. So that's why at this point this is only proportional to this probability, and that's why there was the proportional mark here in the theorem. And now for the second part, we just need to realize that this on policy distribution can be rewritten by starting in some state using this initial state distribution H, and then just using the discounting probability of actually getting to the S prime. So this is all just the formalism of combining it together, right? So this is just the non-policy distribution. So we get the final result. So that's a good thing. We are actually able to compute the gradient of the value function. We want to maximize our expected return, so we will minimize minus j just because it would be more convenient for us. And usually we just minimize when we train neural networks. And if this is our loss function, then the gradient of it will be according to the policy gradient theorem, the expectation over the states, sum over the actions of the action value function of the state and action, times the gradient of the policy with respect to this action and state. So this first sum, that's really an expectation, that's fine. The second sum is not an expectation, it's really a sum which will not be that great. The thing is, if we don't want to compute all actions in the given state, then it would be better if we could just sample the actions, especially because we will need this Q estimate, which will tell us how good this action is in the given state. And in order to avoid obligation to go over the actions, we could just use sampling. For example, in the SARSA, we only sample the action AT plus one, right? While in the expected SARSA, we go over all the possible actions. So here we go in the opposite direction. The theorem tells us that we should go through all the actions, but we don't want to, because we don't want to generate this many estimates of the action value function. So instead of summing, we would prefer sampling. However, in order to sample, we would need this sum to become an expectation. So what we can do Well, we can imagine this as being an expectation, right? It includes the probability of A under the target policy pi internally. So we would need to do an important sampling in a, and once again use 1 over pi I to like cancel this samples according to the policy and not uniformly, and then there will be the rest of the expression, right? So in a sense, like this sum takes or uses the actions unweightedly, uniformly, but we want to be able to sample from the target policy, from the pi. So you can look, consider this to be an important sampling ratio factor, which actually corrects for the difference between the uniform policy and the policy which we are interested in, the pi policy. Also, we can note or we can realize that the gradient of the policy pi divided by the pi itself, it's actually the gradient of the logarithm of the policy, right? Because the gradient of the logarithm of anything, that's the derivative of the outer function, which is 1 over f, right? Times the gradient of the inner function, which is exactly what we have here. So we introduce this pi over pi factor, merge the upper one to the expectation, merge the lower one into the logarithm, and we get the final expression, which tells us, okay, the gradient of the loss function is the expectation where the states go from the on-policy distribution, actions go from the policy pi, and the value which we want to compute is the q value estimate, the state action value function for the given state, for the sample state and action, and then the gradient of the negative logarithm of the policy. So this is actually the negative log likelihood of the action A. So that's what we want to minimize. And there is still last one value which we need to deal with, which is this Q value estimate, right? We need to know how good this action A is in the given status. What we will do is we will estimate it by a single sample, right? So we will run one episode from this state and then action, and we will just get the estimate. In the case of using the Monte Carlo-like rollout, we will just repeat until the episode ends, and when it ends, we will just sum the discounted rewards as a return, and that will be our sample. So that's our first policy gradient algorithm. It's Monte Carlo-like because it will simulate the whole episode until the end. So we simulate the whole episode until the end by following the target policy, and what I mean, well, we should be following the behavior policy, I'm sorry, which means we sample the actions proportionally to the distribution which this policy describes, and then when the policy ends, the episode ends, we want to go through all the states and actions which we sampled, right? So it will be these states and actions, and for each of them we will do the update. We will use the discounted sum of returns rewards as the estimate of the return, and then use just this negative log likelihood as the loss function. So when you look at it from the view of deep neural networks, this is just a supervised standard cross entropy loss update, right? So if we train the network and give it the goal action A, which it should perform in the given state, and this is exactly what the update will look like, but without this Q value estimate, right? So this loss is actually still similar, but compared to the supervised case, this the action was just sampled. It's not a goal action, right? So we need to use this reward from the environment somehow, when we use it here to multiply the gradients with it. And if this is large, then these updates will be more strong, more often performed than for actions which behave not that that good. And for these, the updates will be smaller. Yep. So that's the basic reinforce algorithm. Even the algorithm is quite simple. It is, I would say, very strong, and many many good results are actually based on it. Of course, the problem is the Monte Carlo like behavior, which we will improve later today in the lecture. But we will need to deal with several details before we get to it. First is this on policy distribution. So in the proof, we assumed that this discount factor gamma is used as this form of termination, right? In the definition on the on policy distribution. So what does it mean that if you consider a very long episode, then these are the initial states. Let's say that there's just one initial state. So after performing another step, another step, another step, another step, another step, then each of these steps like adds this gamma either to the rewards, or they are it's added to the returns. Okay, that doesn't make sense. Either you add it to the probabilities of actually going to some different state, right? This means this termination form, or you use it for computing the returns from the rewards, which are far in the future. In any case, it means that if a state is quite far from the initial state, then its influence on the behavior in this initial state will be minor. Right, this gamma to d, if this is distance d, is too large, might be too large, and the changing the behavior at this point will not influence the behavior in the initial state as much. Well, that's one of the reasons why we have discounting, right? So that we can just ignore effects which are too far in the future. However, the problem is that after the agent is trained, it is usually evaluated without discounting. So training only for the beginning of the episode, if it's very long and we are strongly discounting, then would kind of make the evaluation in this setting quite bad, right? Because by default, when we use this termination or include the termination in the on policy distribution, then we would just ignore the state which are too far in the future to actually influence the reward from the initial state. So in practice, this distribution mu, which is used in the reinforce, is almost always without the termination condition. I am actually not aware of any implementation or paper that would use it, apart from some of the algorithms in the deep reinforcement book, but like in some real implementation, even if discounting factor is being used, it's not reflected by this distribution mu in the reinforce algorithm. So this means we are actually able to learn even in the states which are very far from the initial one. So even if their influence on the discounted return in the initial state is very low, we still want to train an agent which is actually able of behaving not just in the initial state but also in the state in question. So in a sense, this mu in the on policy distribution is usually does not include discounting. Contrary to this Q values, which do. So I'm not sure this has some reasonable theoretical understanding, other than that you say that you just are interested not in this mu distribution, but in the one which actually does not include the termination condition inside. And I wasn't able to find any better explanation for it than that we just want to do it like it. Yep. So, for example, if you look at the algorithm, there is a place missing, right? Because in the deep reinforcement learning book, they have also gamma to t here. But if you add gamma to t here, then the algorithm like stops learning for states which are too far from the initial ones, which makes sense if you really want to optimize with respect to the discounted return. But the problem is that you often use the discounting just for better training to like converge faster for very long episodes. And in this case, you still want to evaluate using the undiscounted return. So you just ignore the discounting at this position. Any questions? No questions. So that's one thing what we have dealt with. Second thing which we need to deal with is the variance. The variance of the estimator of the reinforce algorithm is actually quite large. The problem is that we are taking only one sample of the, like we estimate the action value function using one point sample. And we are also sampling the strategy, so the trajectory. So all this sampling, of course, make the variance go higher. However, there is a very simple and very effective way how we can decrease the variance of the estimator. The main observation is that when you have in some given state and there is an action A1 and action A2, then if you get an estimate telling you that Q of S and A1 is 10, you don't know whether it's good or bad, right? The rewards can be arbitrary. So just seeing 10 doesn't mean that this is a good action or a bad action. It depends on whether the real value of this second action is 20 or 0, right? If it's 20, then 10 is bad. On the other hand, if it is 0, right? If the other action gets you 0 discounted return, then 10 would be a great thing, right? So the action value estimates by themselves, they don't mean anything. If you consider how the SGD will train in these situations, so imagine that we have selected this action and now I don't know, let's say that this action, we have sampled this action A1, we are performing the update of the gradient times 10, and now if the other action is 0, then that's a good thing, right? You are going to the right. In the next, maybe we will just sample the A2, we will go left by 0, so we will stay on the same place, then maybe we will also go right to the 10, and so on, so on, so on. So generally we will be moving towards generating this action A1 in the given state with this speed, so that's a good thing. However, consider that the other action has the expected return of 20. So when performing A1, we will actually update the policy to strengthen the behavior of generating this action A1 in this state. Then maybe we will sample also this action A2, and that will tell us to go by the factor of 20 in the opposite direction, right? So now we are more keen or more prone to actually generating A2. Maybe then we generate A1 again, so we will go to the right, and then we might go to the left, and so on and so on. So even if the movement or the change of the parameters to generate the action AI more, A1 more, is not a good one, right? It goes in the opposite way of what we want to do, we will still be able to converge because we will also choose the action A2 and we will perform the updates for the A2 more strongly. But the convergence can really be like back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, which is what I am calling noisy, right? Because you do the update even in the direction which you don't like, right? Maybe you perform the update in the direction to the right, even if you don't want to. You don't want to generate more of the action A of A1. You want to generate more action A2. However, we can fix this quite straightforwardly. And the thing is that we can make or we can give the return estimate some meaning so that we will be able to just from the value to see whether it's like a good action or a bad action. Technically, we will do it by using a so-called baseline. So the baseline in the state BS should give us probably something like an average return in the given state, right? That's why it's called a baseline. And then in the policy gradient theorem, we will not just use the Q value estimate, but we will subtract the baseline from it, right? So imagine the baseline to really be the average. So then this factor will tell you whether this action A is better than average in this state or it's worse than average, right? And better than average probably means I want to do it because, it's better than average, so my average score will go high, will increase. And if some action is worse than an average, then I want to stop doing it because if I stop doing it, then once again, the average will increase, right? So it's when this the baseline is the real average, then all of the updates will go in the good direction. Like we will immediately reinforce the actions which are better than average, and we will stop doing actions which are worse than average, which means we will reinforce actually doing some other actions. So there will be no going back or forth. We will just go in the good direction. However, technically, the theorem works for any value of the baseline. It kind of makes sense because they have no meaning, the reward. So if you have an environment and you just add plus one to all the rewards, then the behavior should not really change. Well, it depends on some factors, but generally it should really not matter much. It's a bit tricky. However, in the policy gradient theorem, it's not tricky. It's actually very simple. So this baseline, it can change depending on the state S, but it must not depend on the action A. Now to see that the baseline doesn't really influence the results, consider how it will influence it. So there will be this sum over all the actions. There is this baseline function and the gradient of the policy. But because this baseline function does not depend on the action, and that's the crucial property, then we can move it before the sum. So we have the baseline times the gradient of the policy when summed for all the actions. However, this is a distribution, so it sums to one, and the gradient and sum can also be swapped. So we will get the gradient of the sum over all the actions of the by A given S. This is, of course, one. The gradient of one is zero, and so the gradient of this loss function is not influenced by any value which we use if it depends only on the states and does not depend on the action. So even if we can use any value, it can be shown that the value which minimizes the variance of the estimator is the expected return. We have already notation for it. That's the value function of the given state, right? In that case, as I tried to illustrate, the SGD gets a nice meaning, right? So let's get here, right? So when we are performing the updates, then this is the direction which makes the network to generate more of action A in the given state. So it's the direction, like is the change in the parameters, which if we perform, the network will generate A more strongly, more eagerly in the given state. So if this value is less than zero, it means this action is better than average, which means we actually want to perform it. So, and that's exactly what the SGD will do. It will change the behavior to reinforce the generation of this action A. However, if this is negative, which means the action is below the average, we want to stop performing this action and do something else. In the supervised setting, somebody would give us the gold action and we would reinforce generation of this gold action. But in this situation, we cannot, we don't know what the gold action is. So what we instead do is we at least try performing less of the action A, right? This is a negative value. So we go in the opposite direction, which means we stop generating A in this situation. Well, the network will probably reinforce all the other actions. So hopefully in some other trials, it will be able to find some other direction which will be better than average, and that one will be reinforced, right? But whenever we are seeing a bad action, the only thing which we can do is like to back off and say, okay, I'm done with doing the action. Please try generating it less, which of course means that some other actions will be need to be generated more, because that's how the softmax thinks. Yep. So that's the baseline. By the way, this value of the Q value function minus the value function, that's something we have already seen in the dualink double Q learning, right? It also has a name. It's called an advantage function, and tells you exactly like how will the rewards returns improve if you perform this action A instead of performing a random action. Instead of performing an action according to the policy pi, not a random one, well, a random one, but random one according to the policy pi. So if we want to change this into an algorithm, we will need to get to know what this baseline will be. We would like to know the value function in the given state. Well, we will be only able to approximate it by having another network or part of the network to actually predict it. However, we don't really mind if we predict it incorrectly, because the convergence or the theorem works with any value of a baseline function. And the better our estimate is, the less noisy the gradient of the policy will be. So generally, we are happy if it's a good estimate, but even if it's not, it doesn't mean our model will diverge just because of that. So in order to approximate it, we will need the part of the network which will predict it. So either we can make two independent networks, like each getting S and the first generating pi, probably using some softmax activation, right? And then we can have another network which will generate just one number, which will be the V pi S. Or we can share some beginnings of the network and then at some point create the policy and create the V pi S. Know that if you want to share the network together for the policy network and for the value network, then you need to make sure that the gradients which go here, both from the policy and from the the value had are reasonably comparable, which is usually not true if the rewards are large. For example, in the card poll assignment, these numbers will be like hundreds, because the average return is 250, while these numbers, the gradient of them will be something like ones. So the gradient coming from the bottom is much larger, which will make the network trying to make sure that this value part works better than the policy part, which is not good for convergence. So generally, care needs to be taken in order to make sure that the network has enough capacity to actually learn even the policy, even if this value head usually has larger gradients. If there is some there are some reasonable normalizations, then they can take care of it for yourself. If you use Huber loss or something for the value function, then again can cut the gradients to be in some reasonable range. But one has to think about it when you attach multiple heads if they contribute with a similar gradient. So we train this value network similarly to how we trained the deep Q networks, right? Well, in the deep Q networks, we also consider different actions. Here we don't, but other than that, we just do the same thing. So whenever we have sampled the episode, we have the estimated return in this state, right? Because we have simulated an episode. Well, now we have the sum of the discounted rewards. That's 1 point estimate of the return, and we can use this as a target for training this value function in this given state. This results in the following algorithm. So we have two set of parameters: the policy ones and the value ones. Once again, we simulate the whole episode because we are still in the Monte Carlo-like version. And once we have done it, we will compute the return. Here, that's the temporal difference error, right? So that the estimated return minus the baseline. Okay, so this is not what I said it is. This is actually the advantage function, right? This is the observed return. This is the estimated average return in the given state. And now we do two updates. One is the update to the policy network, which just uses this advantage function instead of the full return, the non-baselined, non-averaged return. So that's one place. And then we also need to update the value network, right? That's this part. What we do is we just use the mean square error loss. So we say, okay, we will update these W's by looking at the G minus V hat squared and the gradient of this. And the gradient of this, well, that's exactly G minus V squared times the gradient the V square, which is exactly what's written here, even if it doesn't look much like a mean square error loss, but it is. So that's the baseline. There is the baseline is extremely effective, especially in the environments where zero is not a natural reward. If you, for example, try to solve the card poll assignment, then you will usually see rewards which are like hundreds, right? So using this advantage function is very, very useful, because otherwise all the returns would be just positive and you would always reinforce your behavior to generate more of the actions which we have just sampled, which would increase the noisiness of the training. There is one specific example shown in the reinforcement learning book. Just shows you that the convergence of the reinforced with baseline can be much, much faster than the one without it. I have to admit that I don't recall which assignment does this connect to, so it's quite a less like non-informative image. So questions? No questions, it's simple. So let's get rid of this Monte Carlo part of the reinforced algorithms. We will now combine both the policy gradient methods and the temporal different methods to like get everything right, to get the possibility of producing the policy gradient while also being able to bootstrap, so that we don't have to train for the whole episode before we are actually able to learn something. These algorithms, which combine the policy gradient method and the temporal difference method bootstrapping, are called actor-critic methods, or actor-critic algorithms. And the idea is straightforward. We will just use the reinforce as we just introduced it, but instead of computing the G as the full episode return, we will use bootstrapping. It can be n-step bootstrapping, so we can easily say something like, okay, let's consider the rewards t plus i goes from 0 to I'm not really sure if this would be 1, and so like this times gamma to I plus gamma to m times the value function in the state as t plus n, right? Something like this. So we already train this value function in the reinforcement with baseline, because we use it as a baseline. So in the actor-critic algorithm, we don't need to make the network more complex or something. We just use the same part of the network, but not just as the baseline, but also as the estimate of our of the return using bootstrapping. So when you look at the algorithm, it looks very similar. This is one-step version, and here instead of the full return, we have one-step bootstrapping, one reward gamma times the estimate in the next state. This minus v, that's just to get the advantage function, and we use this both for updating the policy and the value function itself. This is once again a semi-gradient algorithm. So similarly to the TD methods in the function approximation, we are not really sure whether it converges and whether it converges to the right value. But as before, we just hope that it works, and empirically it seems that it does. We can now use all our n-step methods, which we talked about, or you've even implemented them to make the estimate of the return less noisy. Yep. Any questions? This was straightforward, I would say. And now let's see some real world application. The same group which presented this deep Q network for the first time published a very different and interesting paper 2 years later in 2015. And this time they used the actor-critic method instead of a deep Q network. What they did is they proposed an asynchronous framework where multiple workers were sharing one neural network, and each was training using either an online or an offline reinforcement learning algorithm. And what they compared was one-step Q-learning, one-step SARSA, n-step Q-learning, and something what they called A3C, which like A3C, which it means an asynchronous advantage actor critic method. And for this A3C, they consider versions with and without recurrent neural network on top. So the main, most interesting part, of course, is this A3C part, because we were already able to use the Q-learning methods. But with the advantage actor critic, we get full distribution over the actions. And the good thing about the actor critic algorithms, they are usually on policy algorithms, right? We haven't seen any off policy version yet. We haven't even proved the policy gradient theorem for the off policy version. That's disadvantage on one hand, right? Well, just not being able to use off-policy learning might be a big problem, because we won't be able to use the replay buffer. That's one of the issues that Q-learning automatically dealt with. Well, we could have just used the replay buffer without any problem, without storing any important sampling ratios or something. We just sampled the transitions from the past and we were fine. With actor critic algorithms, it's usually much more complex, because for the off-policy versions, we will need the explicit important sampling ratios corrections, which are very noisy, as we have already seen. So that's, on one hand, it's a disadvantage of these methods. On the other hand, if we decide to learn the agent on policy, it allows us to, for example, add a recurrent neural network on top of our agent, right? So our agent can use LSTM to actually remember decisions or states from the previous time steps. Once you have a model which uses a recurrent neural network, then you have, and it's much easier to train it in an off-policy algorithm, right? You just train it, and if you have the current state where you got while processing the beginning of the episode. If you instead want to use a Q-learning with a recurrent neural network, then if you start the states of the LSTM in the transition in the replay buffer, then it would probably not be valid for the current target policy, right? After some time, you would process the beginning of the episode differently, which means the LSTM would give you a different state. So training now with the old LSTM state would not really work, right? So for these recurrent neural networks, we need, I'm not saying it's necessary, but it's much more straightforward to train them with an on-policy algorithm. So well, that's what the authors did. However, you all know that the neural networks suffer from this catastrophic forgetting issue. So updating the network from one stream of one episode will make it diverge very likely it will just diverge when it sees 5 minutes of trying to catch one specific enemy in some game, for example. And this is why the authors propose this asynchronous framework, because it means that at the same time there will be several actors running, I don't know, let's say 16 actors will be running in parallel, which means you will see batches, and these batches will maybe be of size 16, and they will contain steps or states from 16 different episodes. So this will diminish or decrease the problem of the catastrophic forgetting, so that because the network is seeing at least some number of different episodes. So hopefully these episodes cover the whole space of all the possible states, or at least some reasonable part of it, and make the training diverge. So that's how they dealt with this on policy thing, right? So, okay, we are training on policy. So that means we are using a lot of agents, right? In the deep queue network, what did we do is we had one agent, and it stored all its experience in the replay buffer. And we dealt with this issue of having uncorrelated examples in the batch by sampling from the replay buffer. Right, we could use prioritized replays and things like that, but we just sampled from different episodes. So hopefully the batches were reasonably diverse, or the examples in the batches. Here in the on-policy algorithm, we cannot return to the history. So what we do is we create a lot of parallel running agents, and we train by seeing examples from one of the episodes each of these ones. What we didn't talk about yet is how to make sure that the exploration continues even in the policy gradient methods, because if we do not make sure that the exploration doesn't stop, easily the policy written by the model could become one hot or very deterministic, which would prevent us from sampling the actions. Right, we are sampling the actions according to the written distribution, and the distribution is very close to all zeros and one, then we will just sample that one action, we will stop doing exploration, and everything will fall apart. So in order to encourage exploration in the policy gradient method, people usually use the entropy regularization. So what we do, we add the entropy the loss, which means we will try to, okay, it needs to be the negative entropy, right? Right, we add minus entropy to the loss, which means we are trying to maximize the entropy of the generated distribution. So what we are doing is we are penalizing the distributions which are too deterministic. If there is just one action with probability of one, then the entropy is zero, right? Because there is no surprise in it, no self-information, and that we want to discourage. So we say that we also want the model to actually generate distributions which are at least a bit stochastic, at least a bit surprising. It's up to the model to decide which of these additional actions actually makes sense to consider. So it's still better than doing this hard epsilon greedy exploration, because we just say, okay, we want to consider also some other actions with some probability, or with some strong or force, with some coefficient, with some weight, but it's up to you, network, to decide which actions these should be, right? So this entropy regularization is usually added with some strength argument beta, which tells you how strong this effect should be compared to the real, to trying to optimize the real return. Yep. So generally, I would say it's a good idea to use it nearly always, because without it, there would be no exploration, and we have seen that exploration is important. So how does this asynchronous implementation looks like? Well, they just used multi-CPU computers, so each core just ran one of the agents, and they shared the memory real the network really shared through the shared memory, so everybody was accessing the same place for the weights of the network. And they perform these updates in this Hogwild SGD version. I don't know if we have probably heard that, but this Hogwild SGD algorithm just performs the updates in parallel from all these threads without taking care of regularization, of locking and synchronicity and something. Just when somebody wants to update the weights, they do it. If they collide and one of these updates get overwritten, well, bummer, it happens. It has actually been shown at some point that these overwrites in the updates actually have the regularization effect because they add some additional noise to the training. We have a lot of asynchronous agents where they share the weights. They shared also the target weights, right? Because this is DQN. This is still one-step Q-learning. We have a target network. We have a shared counter. And now each agent will perform one step with the epsilon greedy policy. This is still just a Q-learning, right? Then we get a new state, new reward. We estimate the return in the next state using the target network. Then we accumulate the gradients. So we don't perform it immediately, but we accumulate them for some time. And then we update the network only each number of steps. This I target is by default 5. So we update the changes for 5 steps, and then we update the shared. This is the async update. Async update is 5 here, which means we are asynchronously updating the weights using our gradients. So we do 5 steps, we compute the gradients, and then we just push them to the shared network. And once upon a time, one of the workers also update the target networks. I think it's each 10,000 steps or something. I'm not really sure. There is the table with hyperparameters later. So this is just the version without a replay buffer, right? So instead of replay buffer, we have multiple parallel agents. We can do this also for the end step update. So it's the same. Maybe it's interesting. What we'll do is we take n actions. And then we compute the end step returns. And what do we do? Well, we have done 5 actions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So when computing the return for the initial state, we actually consider all possible rewards which we have seen. Then computing the estimate for the second visited state, we only use this n-1 rewards, and then n-3, and so on and so on. So we do 5 steps, and then we do whatever we can in that situation. So we just do shorter and shorter updates for the states which get closer to the end of this number of steps which we performed. And it's just not probably important. We could have easily just done it for all the really for n steps in every state, but probably because it was easier to do it, they implemented it like this. But the most important part is this one, which is the A3C implementation, asynchronous advantage actor critic. So actor critic just means we are using both the policy gradient and the bootstrapping. This advantage means we are using a baseline, right? So this is just the different name for the baseline, and this last aid is asynchronous one. So how does it work? Well, once again, we perform some number of steps, imagine 5 steps. Then we compute the estimates, once again, by using the n-step returns, but one step for the just like five steps for the first state, four steps for the second state, and so on and so on. And we compute both the gradient of the value function of the one which predicts the V and the gradient for the policy function which predicts the policy. There is no target network here. We just update everything what we have, and that's it. And once we have prepared the gradients for all these five steps, we asynchronously update the shared network with it, and that's it. Okay, so the target network is updated each 40,000 frames. Other than that, the network is quite similar to the DQN. It's just a bit less rich. It's a bit easier to train, because only CPUs are actually used in this approach. So it makes sense to make the network less computationally demanding. So there is only two layers of convolutions instead of three, and this fully connected layer is 256 units instead of 512. But other than that, the architecture is very similar. And for the A3C, they also have a version which processes this 256 units via recurrent neural network. Is here. All experiments use a discount factor of 0.99, but they didn't consider it as a form of termination in the policy gradient, and they use RMS prop with momentum. So here are the results compared to the original DQN, or even double DQN, or dualing double DQN, or prioritized DQN. They were able to achieve very interesting results by training on a smaller amount of time on a CPU only. Well, the median is not larger than here, but the mean definitely is. Here you can see the training curves. The yellow one is the A3C, and the blue one is the original DeepQ networks. So even their one step Q network, that are the green ones, seem to work better than the original DeepQ network. So that sounds nice. Here is the speed up obtained by using some number of actors. This is quite interesting. Like, if we use one thread, then there is some baseline. Now, if we use two threads, then there is a three times speed up for a one step queue network, which sounds weird, but it's caused by the fact that when you have two threads, you also have two agents. So the batches which you see for the updates are much more diverse than just seeing one state of a single episode. So that's why, for example, using 16 threads make the training go 24 times faster. Well, that was because that with one thread, it was learning very slowly and it was difficult to converge. For the actor-critic algorithm, the speedups are like sane. So they are not much larger than the number of threads which were actually used. Well, this is probably not very interesting, but in this top row you can see the curves for various environments, and it shows you a different number of threads. So this blue one, you just one thread, and then the green one two, and the yellow one 16 threads, the largest number of threads they considered. And this is the number of training epochs. So in theory, it all could look like this if the training was as effective using the multiple agents than using just one. So that probably wasn't very understandable. So let me show you the next image and that will be better. So this is the same graph, but this time we have a training time here, right? So this is the number of batches, and this is the wall time. when considering the number of batches, then ideally these curves should be the same, right? Either I make some number of batches with one agent, or I perform one batch with that many agents. However, you can see that sometimes using larger number the actors can make the results better, explicitly or exactly because of this speed up, which is larger than 16, right? That sometimes using more diverse set of agents make the whole training go faster. But when you consider also the wall time, really like the time which you need to perform the training, you can see that there are much larger gains for using these 16 number of threads, because with 16 number of threads you can do 16 times many updates per time interval than with just one thread. So that was quite interesting. So I will not go into the parallel advantage actor critique. I will leave this for the next next course. I just want to say one last thing. The A3C algorithm was actually very tricky to make it converge. They didn't say it in the paper, and people started re-implementing it because it seemed like great, like no GPUs required, we can use multiple threads, we can train faster, we can train on policy agents which can include LSTM, so they can actually remember their previous decisions, they can plan in some better way and so on and so on. But people were it was very difficult to re-implement these results compared to the deep network, which was reasonably fast. In the end, it was discovered, or maybe it was just the rumors, that the success ratios of training an agent in this A3C setting was very low. So only something like 5% of experiments actually converged, and the rest of them were like really like a lot of zeros. And it took some non-trivial amount of time before the training like saw some kind of a progress. So a lot of people like try to re-implement things, and they thought that they have implementations which don't work. However, they worked sometimes after non-trivial amount of computations of the time elapsed. So people then were able to like realize this, and they were able to train. But I would say that this asynchronous approach didn't win. Like the A3C was present in many benchmarks for quite some time, especially because it was one of the first networks where the recurrent neural networks could be used as well, which has a lot of advantages. But the stability of the training was very poor, and also the possibility of scaling of using GPUs and better hardware or more parallelism was quite limited because of this requirement of this shared memory shared between the agents. So nowadays people have started using use different architectures which allow for better parallelizability, like in the PAAC, which we will talk about on the next course. So thank you for your attention. It's already dark outside. So before we will say goodbye, are there any questions? Yep, definitely. So stay here and don't leave. I will ask the other if they have some other questions, and then we can go through this through the solution. Yep. So some other questions. Doesn't seem so. Okay. So thank you for your attention. Let's meet again on Wednesday, or at least on the Wednesday recording. We will have two assignments on the reinforced algorithm and one small competition assignment just for processing also some images with the reinforced algorithm. So that's the plan on Wednesday. Enjoy your evening. Have a nice Tuesday and see you on Wednesday. So bye-bye. And we can then turn to the